Hi everyone, thanks for coming. My name's Lucian Wishick. This topic is called How We Do Language Design at Microsoft. The reason I'm speaking about this is I'm the specification lead for Visual Basic, and as part of the co-evolution policy, it means I sit on the C-sharp language design meetings as well, and someone from C-sharp sits on the Visual Basic, and really we design the two languages hand in hand. Anders Heiselberg was going to come. I think he's had to leave early to catch a plane. And I felt a bit weird giving this talk when he is Mr. Language Design. He's in charge of both C-sharp and VB. But I have a unique qualification, and that's that I'm quite new to the job. So what I'm going to be telling you is kind of what I learn as someone who used to be an outsider to this, as I gradually get used to the language design thing. And that means I'm probably closer to what you would experience from the language design perspective. I became the spec lead for Visual Basic full-time about 6 months ago. Let's start by talking about the market for the language. Oh, the other thing that's new here, this is the first time I've tried to give a talk in Word rather than PowerPoint. We'll see how that goes. From the market perspective, talking about managed languages, managed type-safe languages, basically the market is split between Java, C-sharp, and VB, in roughly the proportions that we see there. And the market we look at, I've drawn it as this pyramid, and I haven't written .NET into the pyramid yet, but at the top of it, we're looking at kind of enterprise programming, massive, type-safe, for expert programmers. And this really is dominated by .NET and Java nowadays. In the middle, more people doing it are kind of applications, desktop, databases. When you're a consultant, you'll be consulting on this kind of thing normally. There are more people doing this. Visual Basic 6 used to be the crown of this market, and since then there hasn't really been anything quite as integrated and neat as Visual Basic 6. Nothing quite hits the mark that well. And then at the bottom, line of business applications, in-house things, stuff that's done in VBA, in PHP, frameworks, JavaScript. That's massive amount of development work is happening there. That's the biggest segment. And C-sharp and VB haven't really made many inroads into that segment. Really, it's dominated by PHP and Plan 9. Thinking about the middle segment that used to be owned by VB6, the question is, what's happened to it? And the answer, really, we believe, is that it's just become a heck of a lot more complicated. Before, you could just create a form, stick buttons on, connect to the database, you were pretty much done. But nowadays, if you write a decent application, you really have to make it internet-enabled. You have to be aware of latency. You have to be aware of what will happen if it becomes disconnected. You have to work with internet protocols. You have to have entier stuff, some on the client, some on the server. You have to deal with multi-core, otherwise it won't be good. You have to put Chrome into it, security, blah, blah, blah. The landscape for working programmers has become a heck of a lot more complicated, and I don't think there is a magic bullet now like there used to be. The language design bit. By the way, I've written a code snippet here in VB. This talk will be an equal mix of Visual Basic and C-sharp. The languages, when they're designed, they start with such good intentions. They start pure and clean, and they have a simple, direct thing. Like in C-sharp, it was, our thing is going to be a clean, managed language with garbage collection. Or when Visual Basic version 1 started, the principle there was, we're going to make Windows desktop development the easiest way you can write applications ever. And they really succeeded at that. But then the question is, as the language matures and it goes through more releases, how much can we graft onto the language without spoiling the original clarity and purity that it used to have? If we start asking the programmers to deal with too many concepts at the same time, then it's bad for the programmers. And if we have too many concepts that don't quite fit cleanly together, then that's awkward for the programmers as well. In the case of Visual Basic, can we manage these additions to the language over 3 decades of programming. That's a heck of a lot. Here in this sample, lines 10 to 70, this is perfectly valid modern Visual Basic. It will compile clean on Visual Basic 2010. The only thing that's, and it would have compiled clean on QBasic back in the 80s. The only thing that's different is the module one, the submain, the kind of junk stuff that none of us really care about at the top and the bottom. But the core programming language is still completely compatible. Actually, one of the experiments we're working on at the moment is what Anders calls single-line programming. The question is, with the REPL loop and stuff, can we get back to programming without any of that boilerplate stuff at the top, without having to have using clauses and static class programs, static void main? If we could just get into the heart of the program, then it really would look exactly like a QBasic program. That's quite an achievement. But what we get to is this point where, after several decades, and Anders said yesterday that C-sharp celebrating its 11th year, that's quite a lot too, have we added so much junk that it's time to tell programmers to just start with a clean slate and switch to a completely new, clean language designed from scratch? Would that be better? Well, if we do a bad job and we make it a bad language, then programmers should switch. But I think we've succeeded, and you shouldn't switch, basically. Why do I think we've done a good job? Well, think in the case of Visual Basic, how it started back, say, in the 80s and 90s. It was a structured programming language. That means you didn't use go-tos anymore, you used subroutines. Okay, that was an achievement. Adding in a type system, adding in object-oriented programming, adding in functional programming with lambdas and stuff, adding in the declarative style of programming. VB has its handles, clauses, and its XML literals, very declarative. Hopefully, we want to add in immutability. We want to add in concurrency. We've already got concurrency, partly in the shape of the task parallel library. We've successfully navigated through enormous paradigm shifts in programming language theory, programming language design, and we're still trying to do. And the rest of this talk is going to be 3 case studies in how we're trying to manage that transition, how we're trying to add new paradigms on without breaking the existing language. One thing that is really important for this is to have a language specification. Without the specification, oh, you're all programmers, you know what it's like. If you don't have the specification, then everything falls apart. C-sharp started out well. It started out with a really clearly well-written specification. It's not as good as Modular 3. Have any of you programmed with Modular 3? It's a programming language. It's a modern designed one. It's about the expressivity of C-sharp 2 with generics and stuff. It had a complete language definition in just 25 pages, including multi-threading and all of that. That was the most beautiful language specification you can imagine. We're nowhere close to that. Visual Basic had much more of a problem. It started, and this is the worst nightmare, it started from an implementation. From that, we had to reverse engineer the specification. That was a difficult job. It was made really important when the European Union told us we really have to be a lot more careful about documenting the interoperability of our product. Visual Basic for applications was part of Office. It needed a documentation. We had no documentation other than the source code, so we had to devote several programmers full time for 6 months just to reverse engineer what the source code was and write a complete specification. We never want to do that again. C-sharp is going well. Visual Basic has had this specification for several years, and now it's shipped in the product. Both of the languages are. C program files, Microsoft, Visual Studio 10. Let's look at the C-sharp one first. Specifications, in English. It's localized. I'm sorry, I don't think it's localized into Dutch, but you all speak English fluently, I know. And the language specification is all there. And the same with Visual Basic. For the first time, its specification is included out of the box. Actually, what I've been working on for some of this work more recently is the language grammar. I haven't published this yet or told anyone about it. You're the first audience to hear about it. This is the URL if you want to look at it. And what it looks like is, I'll start with C-sharp again. This is the complete grammar of C-sharp, fully hyperlinked. For instance, let's say dynamic keyword, one of the major new features of C-sharp 4. I'll find dynamic. Okay, the dynamic token, colored in yellow means that it's a token that appears in your source code. It's used in this production, class type. A class type is either a type name, an object, dynamic, or string. And it's used in these things, a reference type. A reference type is either a class type, interface type, array type, delegate type. Some of these I didn't know about. This is a great tool to learn about the language if you want to use it. One place where we used it was, for instance, reference type is used in only one production. It's never empty. It may start with any of these words in the language. In the actual source code, it will be one of these. And it may be followed by any of these. Some of these are quite surprising, but dig around and you'll probably find exactly how it can happen. Exactly the same grammar for Visual Basic. One of the things we added in Visual Basic was, Visual Basic has always been a line-oriented language. That means every statement takes one line exactly. That was the idea. It's no longer true. It was no longer true before because you could put an underscore to continue a line onto another line. It was no longer true before because you could embed XML into your VB program, and XML can span multiple lines. And it's no longer true now for two reasons. First, we added multi-line lambdas. They can split over multiple lines. And a lambda is just an expression. So now an expression can split over multiple lines. And secondly, you don't need the underscore character anymore. A line can be split over multiple lines. For the C-sharp users, if you're thinking, that's not very special. I can split C-sharp over multiple lines. But it is special. The reason is that it's the equivalent of, imagine if C-sharp allowed you to insert semicolon anywhere you liked in the middle of sentences, anywhere at all. Okay, now you start to realize that this was a big deal when we added it to the language. The way we added it to the grammar is, for instance, equals used in the assignment statement, x equals y. Equals is just a grammar rule. The grammar rule consists of the equals symbol itself followed by an optional line break. Okay, so what we did with the language feature, we wanted to make the line continuation characters optional. We explored it in the grammar. We did heavy-duty grammar analysis. Those of you who studied language grammars at college, if you did computer science, will understand that we were trying to solve a problem. When you have a grammar where there is one valid sentence in a grammar followed by another valid sentence in the grammar, are there any cases where the first string followed by the beginning of the second string is itself also a valid sentence in the grammar? If we could solve that problem, then we could do the implicit line continuation features easily. Unfortunately, it's been proved that this problem is theoretically undecidable. Okay, that was a bit of a problem. If we narrow it down, we're not trying to solve it in general. We're only trying to solve it for the Visual Basic grammar. We could narrow it down. It took about 6 hours of number crunching on a 4 gigabyte machine, but it got there in the end. And that's how we managed to do that language feature, implicit line continuations, without breaking the existing language and without introducing ambiguities. Okay, so using the language, grammar, and the specification is the number one way that we have to avoid breaking the language when we graft these new features onto it. Let's talk about some case samples here. I have three of them: link, XML, and asynchrony. Link, this is old story, maybe you all know it. It was really tech transferred from an experimental project at Microsoft Research in Cambridge. That experimental language was called C Omega. It looked a bit like C Sharp, but it borrowed a lot of features from other languages that had been around in academia. The tech transfer was mainly driven by Anders and Eric Meyer, the Dutch fellow in the colorful T-shirt. Also, I've put up here a picture of Neil Gafter. He's the other leading language architect we have. He was pretty much Mr. Java at Sun. He left Java a few years ago. He then implemented Google Calendar for Google. He left Google. He came to the VB and C Sharp language design group, and we're really happy to have him here. His first job was to add DLR support to Visual Basic, so he's right in there with the coding as well as the architecture. So how did we do Link? Well, Link had a really straightforward, in retrospect it was straightforward, a straightforward sequence of operations. One, from universities and from academia, from computer science, from 10, 15 years ago, take a few standard foundational computer science features: lambdas, extension methods, quoting. Quoting, I guess, dates from 1921 and Gödel, so it really is a good old-fashioned computer science concept. So add basic features to the language. Step number two, add the new functionality that we want as library features. For Link, we added extension methods. We added extension methods called join and where and select. And these were all library methods first. And the final phase, after we've added them as library methods, is add syntactic sugar to the language, which binds to a blessed library pattern so that users can provide their own libraries as long as they adhere to this standard pattern. Okay, this is old hat and it's standard and you're familiar with how you've seen it in Link, but what I'm conveying to you is that this really has to be the guiding principle for every feature we add to the language nowadays, pretty much. Otherwise, it just becomes impossible. A code sample here says exactly what I've just said, that the new language we add is nothing other than syntactic sugar for the longhand version. Actually, when I ask around the corridors at the VB and C Sharp group in Microsoft, half of the people prefer to write like this. Half of the people prefer to write in the Link style. And actually, the half of the people that prefer to write in this dot style, I ask them, why do you do it? And they tell me the answer is that it makes it easier for them to visualize this collection. It starts here, we do a dot to process it into another collection, we do a dot to process it into another collection. So that's very straightforward. And that comes from another very foundational computer science topic called monads. Monads are the topic that Eric Meyer drones on. He doesn't drone. He talks about it because it's a really important concept that has a really good pedigree in the language Haskell, but it's a bit of a rude word in the actual practical programmers group of us at Microsoft, where We really did not study monads at Computers University because they were a third-level PhD topic only for some people. And whenever we hear the word monad, our brains just shut down. But when we get monads expressed to us in this library, then as concrete programmers, we do understand what's happening. Please, by the way, if any... If you have questions at any time, I'd rather have you stop and interrupt me rather than save them up for the end. The user reaction to Link was great, even from the early days. They could see just how much potential it had. That was great. We released it very early in terms of previews to get an idea, and we got feedback, and we got a sense of the excitement that we had done something good. What we heard from users was, Lambdas, for goodness sake, these are esoteric. None of us understand what lambdas are about. Actually, we still hear that to this day. But that comment has become drowned out by the people who say, lambdas, they're amazing. I use them all the time. They've really helped my code. I use them day to day. And the lambdas have become especially important with the task parallel library, which is using lambdas left, right, and center. I mean, the important lesson to draw there is that when we implement a solid idea from computer science, like lambdas, then we have an enormous heritage to make sure we get it right, to make sure there aren't any edge cases, and we know that it will be suitably flexible to use in general cases in the future. Well, there's what users say. Actually, this was Eric's advice to me. He said, listen, we have to ignore what they say. We have to listen to what they mean. We have to listen to what they need. That's a bit rude, and we really do listen to what users say. But it's really easy for people to sort of jump on a bandwagon of one particular syntax and say, we want this syntax, or find another thing and say, we want this particular feature. And that's really the wrong place for us to be listening to them. What we need to be listening to them, to you, is anyone who says, I need this feature because I have this business problem that I'm trying to solve, or this programming problem that I'm trying to solve. Then we have to understand the problem through and through. We have to understand that it's not just this problem, but this one and this one and this one that can all be solved by a common foundational feature. And that's the time for us to strike. It's totally wrong of us to put it into it with only a single need or a single feature that's driving it. One of the goals of Link was to make things look familiar to SQL programmers, and it really succeeded quite a lot. VB and C-sharp took slightly different paths in this respect, and I'm going to tell you about this difference because I think it was an interesting difference from the language design perspective. Nullable types. A nullable type was introduced in earlier version of Visual Studio. For every type T, we have the nullable type T question mark, which holds either a value of type T or nothing, which means I don't know. Most of you will be using these already. I'm going to be talking from a more theoretical perspective on how we're approaching them. There is an implicit lifting conversion from T to T question mark. That means if you have an integer, it can automatically, implicitly convert it to a nullable integer. Of course, no question about it. Every operator, like plus, times, divide, minus, every operator that takes in of type T and U and gives an answer of type V, like integer plus integer gives an integer, then it automatically has a lifted form, operator question mark. This is all implicit in the language, but it's happening under the hood, which takes in a T question mark, a U question mark, and it gives a V question mark. So, integer plus integer gives integer. That means automatically, without doing anything, that integer question mark plus integer question mark gives an integer question mark. And the meaning of this is that if either argument was nothing or null in C sharp, nothing means I don't know. And if you have 5 plus I don't know, the answer is I don't know. In other words, 5 plus null equals null. Now, what happens when we lift the equals operator? In C sharp, you'd write it double equals. X as an integer equals, nullable integer equals nothing. That means X is an integer, but I don't know what it is. By the way, SQL, no, I'll tell you that in a moment. So X is an integer, but we don't know what it is. What this is doing in Visual Basic is it's using the lifted form of the comparison operator. It's saying, if an integer, which I don't know what it is equal to another integer, which I don't know what it is, then do something. Well, I don't know what it is it equal to I don't know what it is? The answer is, I don't know. So, in Visual Basic, this does not print anything. And the reason is that Visual Basic followed through with this SQL style, this hard line mathematical approach driven, I think, by Eric Meyer largely, which says every operator, like the mathematical purist would express, will be lifted in exactly the same way. That's why Visual Basic does not do what anyone would expect it to do in this particular case. C sharp, on the other hand, approached this with a much more practical hat. And I think this really is driven by Anders. The practical hat said 99% of the world's programmers will not expect what Visual Basic does. Let's do it the way that 99% of the world's programmers will expect. So this code in VB does not do anything. In C sharp, it prints is nothing. Well, that was a bit unfortunate. What we've done in... Sorry, yeah, question.
Short one. So the lifting that you say, like, if you have a non-question mark operator,
yeah.
So lifts it with a question mark operator?
Yeah.
That's done by the language, right?
It's done by the language.
So...
And it's done automatically even for user-defined conversions and operators.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it have been nicer to implement in a way that I could also, you know, add that feature? You understand what I'm trying to say?
So the question was, the lifting is done automatically by the language. Could we have imagined allowing users to describe how the lifting happens? Right. Okay, so just to repeat for everyone, the question was, nullable is then hard-coded into the language. The language special case is the nullable type, and that means that you as developers can't write your own thing that looks like nullable and has a lifted thing in your own way, into your own looks like nullable type. Yeah, that's a good question. The case for nullable was... Nullable had to be baked into the language at the very lowest level, into the .NET runtime at the very lowest level. That's because if you have a nullable integer, it's a structure type, but when you box it, it becomes a reference type with a null value. In other words, the IL machinery in the common language runtime has to know at a very low level about nullable and boxing and unboxing. There's no good way to change the low-level implementation to support user-defined things. We could, at the cost of making it massively slower, and that was definitely not worth it in that case. There are other cases that we've really had to hard code stuff. Tuples. Added a tuple type to Visual Studio 2010. That was important because tuples are, they have language syntax for them in F-sharp, and we want to have good interoperability with F-sharp, VB, C-sharp, IronPython. And that means that whatever F-sharp stores for tuples, C-sharp and VB have to read them natively. We can't have F-sharp going on its own and inventing its own type. And that meant that a tuple type had to be baked in to the .NET runtime somewhere, so it could be used by all of the languages. And that means that tuple-like stuff will not be, we won't allow users to define their own tuple-like class. Whatever we do for tuples will be limited to the Microsoft tuple class. Actually, tuple was an interesting example. I'm going to save for later. I'll put that at the end of the talk. I want to go back to this. Visual Basic, it doesn't do what users expect. And so in Visual Basic 2010, we added a new warning for this. If you type this code, it puts a squiggly underline and it says, warning, this doesn't do what you expect. Consider using is instead. You laugh. We wondered, should we change the meaning of the language to make it like C sharp? That would be a disaster. Why would it be a disaster? It means that people who wrote programs that worked in Visual Studio 2008 without errors, if they paid us money to buy Visual Studio 2010 and they recompiled, it would still have no errors, but it would behave differently. That is absolutely forbidden, completely forbidden in our language design. So we could not follow that route. So instead we added a warning, but even that was hard. Okay, we added the warning, I think about a year ago, so 8 months ago, quite late in the cycle of a multi-year release. We had time to get it into the hands of some early adopters and some customers, and we got back irate emails from them saying, look, I upgraded from Visual Studio 2008 to 2010, and suddenly I'm getting 1,000 errors on my 100 project solution. Here, I've generated a spreadsheet with every single one of the errors that I'm getting. I want you to fix it. And we thought, wait, they weren't errors. We had it as a warning. He said, oh yeah, we turn on warnings as errors. We said, well, can't you just ignore it? He said, no, we're not going to ignore it. And that really was the reality, that people, you told me, that use warnings as errors, and lots of people do that. So we don't have a good way for introducing compile time advisories into the compiler. Even the warnings that we add will break people. And really, it's true that people are paying us money to upgrade, and if we give them grief when they upgrade, we're really not doing them a service. Okay, how do we solve this problem? Well, we make it a configurable warning that is turned off by default when you upgrade a project, but is turned on by default when you start a new project. Okay, it's kind of good, yeah?
Can you switch that off?
Yes. So you can't change the upgrade wizard. It will always turn it off when you upgrade, but after you've upgraded, you can re-enable it. And I'm sorry, when you have 100 projects, you have to click through every single one until you start to write an automatic script which goes through your .vbproj files and updates it manually. It really is hard. I mean, the other vehicle we have for adding this kind of warning is fxcop. You'll run fxcop and it will warn you about violations, and actually it couldn't warn you about this violation because by the time this has been compiled, it's already in IL and you no longer know what the user wrote. So fxcop is unable to provide this warning. That's why we put the warning into the compiler. The other reason is, whenever I ask for a show, let's try here, show of hands, how many of you use fxcop every day? I would say that's 10%. So it's really not much. Fxcop has become kind of a niche, for the people who are really keen on maintaining the quality in a team or an enterprise of making sure everyone sticks for the guidelines, but most developers are not using it. Okay, we have StyleCop, and we're about to release VBCop, and these will provide warnings before it's been converted into IL, more stylistic warnings as well. What we're really hoping is that we can put them as plugins for Visual Studio, and that would make it more natural for people to be using them all of the time. But again, every time we add warnings, it breaks the enterprise customer, oh, God forbid, the ASP person, the ASP developer, where when they make, I can't remember which, ASP project or ASP website, can be compiled on the fly so that when things start to break, it's not the developer that they break for. Oh, no, the developer has finished his ASP project, he's handed it over to his end customer, and the customer a week later says, hey, I'm getting this break in the compile due to warnings as error, and the customer has no idea how to fix it. So the ASP scenario really constrains very heavily on what we can do. The meaning of source code can never change in service packs, because ASP customers will upgrade service packs, but they won't upgrade to an entire new retarget their ASP application. The principle that we're using here for warnings, if 99% of users would expect something, then we should do it. If this code does not do what 99% of users would expect, then we could give a warning. This warning has a 95% likelihood of indicating user error. The numbers are inaccurate, and we don't conduct polls. We just do rough show of hands and get the feedback from audiences. But that really is our driving goal. And that means, actually, there are cases just for code purity. When we as people who try to write tight, clean, pure code would like to give warnings, but we're not introducing them into the languages, because what if there are 10% of customers who have valid scenarios where this warning would be a false warning? 10% is too high, and that makes us... unwilling to introduce a warning for something that has a 10% false positive rate. Okay, so with Link, I talked about one, foundational CS concepts, two, the library, and number three, syntactic sugar on top of it. And I talked about this, how we control for warnings. XML literals, these were the next thing I wanted to talk about. VB only, I'm afraid, for this section. I really like the saying, XML is like violence. If it's not working for you, you're not using enough of it. I'm using a heck of a lot of it, every day pretty much. Here, I've written a small sample. It uses XML literals in Visual Basic. It says, dim XML equals, and then it puts an XML fragment straight into your source code. The reason for this is that XML is being used so frequently, and you don't want to maintain two separate files. You want to put stuff close together where it belongs. And the other reason is that we can do something really beautiful. We can, because we've promoted XML literals to a first-order concept, it means we can embed the language. Here I've put a link query. We can embed it inside the XML, and we can embed XML inside the link query, and then we can embed the language inside that bit of XML that we embedded inside the link query, that we embedded inside the XML, that we embedded inside the language. And it's really useful. And I guess when we're doing PSP or PHP or ASP, we are doing some kind of integration. But by making it a first-order part of the language, we get a much tighter integration, and it's actually really beautiful. Where did XML come from? It came from Transduce. This was a project by Ben Pierce of Pennsylvania State University. It made its way into the C-Omega language again. C-Omega was a really good incubation project. And then it made its way into Visual Basic, driven again by Eric Meyer. How does it work? XML is a declarative way of building data. And you heard Anders yesterday talk about how declarative is the way forwards. So this is one step on the way towards declarative programming. I say it's declarative because the alternative, and if you're using C#, you're going to be using this alternative, is manually constructing this tree by hand, using new X element, new X element, new X attribute to add each of those. Each new statement that you add is an imperative statement. You're calling the add method, but here this is declarative because we're not calling an add statement. We've only got a single expression that means what we want. Your question had been, can we allow users to create arbitrary nullable-like types? And the question here is, could we allow users to create arbitrary XML-like types? Well, what's happened here is XML literals were introduced in Visual Studio 2008. We really did not have confidence that we had explored the entire area of tree structured data well enough. That is, we might have made something like XML, and then we'd have found that a customer wanted to have something that looks a bit like XML, but was not supported by the API that we'd introduced, or something else that was tree structured but wasn't supported, or these things here. We have XML accesses. This one looks for a body element within it. This one looks for all descendants of that type within it. Are those the only two accesses that we should have? Maybe we should have more accesses. Maybe we should have an accessor like getElementById, which is probably the number one accessor used in JavaScript programming. Maybe we need to have more modes of constructing the XML tree. So what we could have ended up with is an awful pattern where an awful situation where we created an XML-like pattern where XML literals could bind to any class library that you write that obeys that pattern, but then we hear that it's useless because we didn't do it well enough. And by the time we'd reached that first stage and we'd baked into the language the pattern that we're using, then we would no longer be able to change it. We've had that problem already, not with XML, but you use the for each statement a lot. And you use link patterns a lot. And for each and link use two different patterns in the language. For each looks for the collection pattern. That means it looks for a method called getEnumerator, or and on that it looks for a property called current, and it looks for a method called moveNext. Meanwhile, link looks for the queryable pattern. It looks for a dot select extension method or instance method or any of the other link patterns. So already in the language, we're stuck with two separate patterns. Why? Well, the collection pattern that we started off was nowhere near up to the task of being used for link queries. But where this hurts us is one of these corner cases that we haven't solved. And it's one that's asked for all of the time. You write for each, what you want to write is for each X in collection where X is above 10. Yeah, not at heads. And you can't write that. And we're not sure how best to do it because where is part of the query pattern and for each is part of the collection pattern. If we graft this on, are we going to graft it via the query pattern? Are we going to say that from now on, for each is going to use the query pattern if there were any query accesses in it, but the collection pattern if it weren't? Or are we going to force for each to use the query pattern in all cases and break something? Or if we force it to use the query pattern, suddenly it's going to be less efficient than the old for each collection pattern, which is pretty damn quick, and it's optimized for use in arrays. Really, you'd want, if you wrote for each X in collection where X is above 10, you want that to be every bit as efficient as the first statement of your for each block being, if X is above 5 or X is above 10, then continue. and the query pattern is not that fast. Well, so we're stuck there. I mean, we're never going to introduce new features that make things slower than what they were in the past. That's not quite true. So we didn't have enough tree-structured examples to give us confidence that we had figured out the ultimate tree data pattern. I tried going to academic universities, to researchers who specialize in tree-structured data, and asked them, what is the mathematical theory of trees in computer science, of tree-structured data in computer science? I mean, that's become a big field with tree-structured databases and the NoSQL movement. And the answer I got back was, there isn't one. We don't have a general theory. Okay, that was a dead end. We didn't have any guidance on that respect. So the principle we followed here is, don't cast the language pattern in stone until we're sure. Until we're sure we've really covered most of the cases. Yeah.
But if there isn't a definitive tree data pattern, you could say, this is ours, Microsoft.
This is the Microsoft way, the one Microsoft way. I love that. Have you guys noticed the street address of Microsoft is one Microsoft way, Redmond, WA98052. It is one Microsoft way. Yeah. I think you're right that we do have to leave. And we've run into stupid problems now, like XML would be the ideal way to program Silverlight from VB or C Sharp. And Silverlight doesn't use XElement. Step back a bit. You're programming Silverlight, new with Visual Studio 2010. You can interact very easily with the document object module, with the DOM. You can interact with it via Dynamic in C-sharp, or with object and late binding in VB. And the way it works is it uses the DLR, and Anders talked about this in his talk yesterday. If only we could write document.innerHTML equals XML literal, that would be so powerful. That would be the most powerful way of any language in the world of programming XML into a JavaScript-like language for writing web pages. And lots of other people write versions of JavaScript or versions of server-side stuff which tries to integrate XML with the client-side stuff or the server-side stuff, and it's never as nice as it could be. If only we had XML pattern in VB working for that, would be set, but it's not. It's cast in stone to only work with XElement. It doesn't work with HTML element, and so we're stuck on that side. It doesn't work with XAML, which is another tree-structured data-like thing. It would be really great. So, yeah, at the moment, we're stepping back. We think now we do have a bunch more examples. Now is the time for us to go back and figure out how we can generalize this pattern into a library pattern so that any user can write their own classes and benefit from XML literals. The XML literals were really difficult to implement. Why is that? XML has a completely different grammar, a completely different lexer, a completely different yak from VB or from C Sharp. What it means is that Visual Basic Compiler has got two completely separate lexers. I don't know how much computer science you know. The lexer is the thing that reads the characters one by one, and it figures out what symbols they mean in the programming language. And we can't do that anymore. I mean, something as stupid as the less than arrow means two completely different things. It either means the start of an XML fragment, or it means the less than operator, or in Visual Basic, it's how we declare attributes. Okay, you can imagine why that grammar tool I showed you earlier on comes in very useful. Actually, let's just see what it says. I'm scrolling up to find the symbols. Okay, this operator. It's an operator, a preprocessor binary operator used in an attribute block, an XML namespace imports clause, blah, blah, an overloadable operator. That's when you define your overloaded operator, comparison operator. Okay, so, yeah, well, that's the thing we have to look at when we're trying to figure out God, especially implicit line continuations with this operator were a real disaster to code, but we got there in the end. Yeah, and we'd really love... So, we've hard-coded one domain-specific language, XML, into the VB language. It would be fantastic if we allowed users to put their own domain-specific language into C-sharp or VB. To some extent, in C and C++, you can do that with macros. To some extent, in Java, you've got a lot of power with annotations, and you can really munch the language around a lot. Macros aren't that nice, and we've really been resistant to going down that route in Java and C-sharp and VB. There are other languages, like, I can't remember the names, but ones where the entire language is user-defined, so that when you're halfway through a statement, the meaning of the following token is completely controlled by the tokens that came before it in the user's own code. Amazing languages, and VB and C-sharp are never going to be that flexible. I mean, these let you define complete languages within the language. F-sharp gets fairly close to that. F-sharp really lets you write natural domain-specific languages inside it. We really don't know a good way to embed user-defined languages inside a language.
Why is it defined not reused?
We think it creates more problems than it solves. There's an old saying in computer science, every problem can be solved by adding a layer of indirection. Okay, that's true. I have a corollary to this. Every layer of indirection adds more problems than it solves. And I really think the same is definitely true of macros, especially, I don't know, I look at our own base. At the moment, VB and C-sharp are written in C++ and use macros all over the place. We're rewriting them inside C-sharp and in VB, and suddenly the code is easier to understand in all of the places. Absolutely, yeah. Yes, I think there are neat ways. So far, we've discussed about 15 neat ways in the C-sharp language design meetings, and all of them are neat in one way or another, and ugly in one way or another, and none of them has yet been quite compelling enough for us to really want to go ahead with it. But yeah, we really recognize that it's needed in some way or other. And people really do ask for macros a heck of a lot. The final example I wanted to talk about was concurrent. And this is not in Visual Studio 2010. So this is watching how we do language design at the stone face as it's happening. Actually, while I've been here at the conference, I've had my inbox full of messages about the design teams exploring the space of solutions here. Here was one stab at the problem we had. The problem we had was... I'm sorry, for those of you who went to my earlier talk, I'm repeating a bit, but that's because asynchrony is a big problem that's the top of all of our minds, really. In Silverlight programming, you can't write blocking operations, like a web request. When you're trying to get the response from a web request, that's a blocking operation. It blocks the thread. Can't do that in Silverlight. If you're writing The normal solution to this is to create a separate thread to do the blocking request. Now imagine if you're writing a code which makes 1,000 requests to web services, tries to do them all in the background, then that's 1,000 threads all blocked in it. And the way Windows is built is that each thread takes 1 megabyte. So we've already wasted 1 gigabyte doing absolutely nothing of worth, just waiting for all of those things. Completely unacceptable. Okay, what's the solution? Well, the problem is, if we could have a pure managed language, a .NET thread, then we could do threading however we want. We wouldn't need to use the processor-based threads. We could have threads just residing on the heap anywhere in memory. They could be garbage collected. They could take as little space as you want. But that doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is every .NET thread basically was created by an operating system function at its top. And every .NET thread that does something worthwhile ends up creating an calling an operating system function at its bottom. Even something as stupid as console.writeline gets mapped down into an operating system call, of course. So there's native code at the bottom and the top of the stack. The stack is really pinned. It's a slave to the operating system threads. And then we're stuck with the fact that Windows just has giant threads. And this is not something that is easy to change. It's not something we can easily change. How does the Google Go language do it? It has very lightweight threads that are not operating system threads. Instead, they're just Go language threads. And whenever one of these Go language threads wants to make a call to an operating system, it doesn't call it directly. It marshals it onto a separate operating system thread. And then they have to audit all of the operating system functions to make sure that none of these are blocking. Because for each blocking operating system call, well, that would screw up the thread that we dedicated for this marshalling and the handoff business. Okay, so we're really stuck. So this was one approach that, just an attempt at it, talking about something called an async method. It's kind of an iterable method. It's kind of observable method. I call it iterable because you start it, it does some work, and then it yields. It tells you, hey, I can't do any more work for now. I'm waiting for some operation to finish. I'm waiting for data to come back from the network. And then when that operation is finished, then we can tell it to do the next chunk of its work, and it does some work, and then it yields again. So it really does feel quite a lot like an iterator. It feels a bit like an iObservable, in the sense that we can observe what it's currently blocked on. It can tell us, hey, I'm currently blocked on this operation, and then we say I'm blocked waiting for this callback from the disk to say that the disk read is finished. Then we can hook into the operating system callback for this disk read, and we can know when we need to trigger it to continue with its work. And so on the async idea, every function becomes iterable in this asynchronous iterable way. And then we have the function, the keyword await. And what await is doing is, well, f.read is another function which itself will have this iterable property. You can tell it to start, it does some work, and then it tells you, hey, I'm blocked. And what the await keyword does is it bubbles up that iterability up to the parent function. So the guy who's sitting at the very top calling this can say, do some work, and that work might be in this function, or it might be inside f.read. Doesn't matter where it's going. It has the same harness to drive all of that stuff. I don't know, it's still kind of complicated. And thinking of the pyramid I started with, do we think that these kinds of things will be suitable for regular programmers? I don't know. It's pretty touch and go. When I joined Visual Basic, it was on a different experiment along these lines. We knew that it's important for you to decouple the user interface from the engine of your program. And we know that the user interface has to make asynchronous calls into the engine of your program so that a blocking operation won't make the UI freeze like it does in Outlook. Or Windows Explorer. I have a lot of freezing applications. And really, every application does need to decouple its UI from its engine. And that's an incredibly difficult task, especially for normal programmers. And the project we did was called VBO, Visual Basic with Orchestrations. That said, that meant we're going to tell people to start writing in this pattern which decouples, and they'll only pass messages from one to the other. Messaging is a nice way of avoiding deadlocks, because you just pass a message and you wait for another message to come back. But I did my PhD on this exact topic, and I thought it was a great idea, but it turns out to be a pretty bad idea. That's because the protocols that you have to get for which messages have to be sent and received at which time are every bit as complicated as the code you'd have to write normally if you weren't using messages. They've just made it a lot harder to discover where the problems are and where the bugs are and where the deadlocks are. So messaging, message passing program, we did another experiment. At TechFest last year, we did a collaboration with Microsoft Research in Cambridge. The final plank of the C-Omega project was a declarative way of handling messages. And we did this experiment called Concurrent Basic. We added declarative clauses into Visual Basic to say how we should handle a particular message. A message might come in from the internet or from your own program. And again, it had this same problem, this inversion of control. It meant that people who were programming this had to manually turn their program into a state machine, basically. A state machine that got a message, moved into another state, and sent out another message. Got another message, switched to another state again, another message. You're thinking to yourself, okay, well, maybe a state machine isn't that bad. But it really is. The great triumph of C-sharp iterators is that there the compiler builds the state machine without you having to worry about it. Let me say another way. I firmly believe that if you want to sequentially compose two things, that means have one thing come after the other, then the operator you should use for the sequential composition should be a semicolon, or a line feed in Visual Basic, unless it's an implicit line feed, blah, blah, blah. It should be a semicolon. And that means that Silverlight breaks down, because when you sequentially compose operations in Silverlight across blocking operations, you're not doing it with semicolons, you're doing it with nested lambdas. You're doing a nested lambda to say this lambda should be executed after the web request has come in or after the disk request has come in. So we've turned semicolon into a nested lambda. A nested lambda is not the right way to do it. Semicolon is the right way. And something like this async would allow us to use semicolon. In fact, here we have it. This is the semicolon that is the sequential composition without any of the state machine. Well, it's still really early days for this experiment. But this experiment, or concurrency more than anything else, comes from a strong background belief that there will be no grand unified theory of concurrency. Let's roll back to 1920 again. Roll back to 1900. David Hilbert, one of the greatest mathematicians of the generation, put forward his great problems of computer science at the 20th International Congress of Mathematicians of Mathematics. Problem number 20 said, what is an algorithm which can tell whether a given mathematical sentence is true or false? Great problem. Everyone thought that there was an answer. It was just a matter of finding what it was. In 1920, Gödel proved that there is no such answer. There's no solution to the halting problem. That's why we have undecidability. And at the time, they thought, oh no, there is no solution to decide whether a mathematical statement is true or false. This is the end of mathematics as we know it. Absolutely false. What it did was it created computer science at the periphery of mathematics on all of these interesting problems that you don't know we don't have an effective procedure to decide whether they terminate or not, but you as programmers are sure as heck writing programs that terminate, and you're exploring interesting sort of spaces outside the realm of this decidability result. I really believe The same is going to be true of concurrency, that there are going to be no grand answer to concurrency, but there are going to be a thousand different interesting problems at the corners. One of the interesting problems will be Philips writing a decoder chip, which decodes HCA, whatever, the codecs for video compression. Another solution will be asynchrony, maybe along these lines. Another solution, I just want to separate concurrency from asynchrony. Concurrency, in our heads, really is about leveraging multi-core processors. And that is a much smaller problem. Well, it's not a small problem, it's an enormous problem, but it's better solved by things like the task parallel library. Asynchrony is about dealing with high latency operations. The high latency operations we deal with are, of course, internet requests and also disk requests. And actually, as we move into the next 5 years, a really big high latency operation we face will be retrieving data from memory. God, that's going to be a nightmare. And pretty much off our horizon, we have no good ideas about how to address this effectively, apart from NUMA architectures where this address range is appropriate for this core, this address range is appropriate for this core, this address range is appropriate for this core, and then imagine the garbage collector, when it comes time to do garbage collection, and it's walking through memory, it can say this object was last accessed by this thread on this core, therefore, when I garbage collect it, I'm going to put it in the memory location that's closest to this core. Okay, that might give some performance. In fact, it does give like a 20% performance improvement on, say, a 64-core machine. But we're still a long way off from solving those problems. Anyway, a giant number of problems in the space of parallelism, concurrency, asynchrony. And we have to come up with something that either solves one of these areas, a big area, really well, or something that's general enough. Oh, the holy grail would be some unified way that you can interoperate between the different models of concurrency. Like 5 years ago, university students were all being taught that threads, mutexes, semaphores, condition variables were the right way to program concurrency. Maybe this is what you were taught as well. And then really not the right way, actually. They're really an ugly way. And the task parallel library has really raised the abstraction bar there to thinking of tasks or lazy or whatever as the basic building block of the concurrency there. You know, I started by saying the concurrency, each thread in Windows is 1 megabyte big. Maybe we need to fight that. Maybe we need to say to the Windows guys, look, this is unacceptable. Maybe we need to use something like fibers, which are already part of Windows. Is there a way that we could fit those into .NET so that .NET can really give the illusion of something that looks like threads, but is a heck of a lot cheaper, just relying on a different operating system mechanism? If we could do that, then Silverlight's restriction would have no sense anymore. Silverlight would be completely free to allow blocking operations, to allow the user to create threads and the blocking things that happen on these fiber-like threads if they were cheap enough. So that's another possible answer to this thing. And we don't know. But as always, the same things. Look for what academia has done. Look for what makes sense to regular programmers, like that lifted operator thing. Figure out what the good library is, and then figure out if we can lift it into the language in some way or other. A syntactic sugar. That's the end of the talk. I just say that we're hiring. There are two positions open on the Managed Languages compiler team, one for Visual Basic, one for C#. So these are fairly high-level things. If any of you, you're all good programmers, if any of you are interested in this kind of job, look it up. You could email me, contact details on my blog to find out more what it is. Or if you have friends or colleagues who are really sharp programmers, please send them my way. And that's it. Thank you very much. Are there any more questions? Yeah.
If you could scroll back just a bit to the asynchronous code.
Yeah.
This function count bytes, is the function asynchronous or does it return an asynchronous integer?
The question was, in count bytes, is the function asynchronous or does it return an asynchronous integer? The function itself is asynchronous.
So, how do I call it? I can't call it like a normal function.
Yeah. So, the question was, how do you call it? You can't call it like a normal function. You need some driver to call it. That is, if you... Well, how do you call it? If the function that you're writing where you want to call count bytes, you could make your own function asynchronous, and that way you could bubble the problem up to whoever calls your function. And it's like Terry Pratchett's Discworld, turtles all the way down. Hey, it's iterable all the way up. But no, ultimately at the very top level, probably at the very top level, there has to be some guy who will take these iterable functions and be a harness for them. And yeah, that would probably be called, I don't know what the best way to do that is, but it's definitely there at the top. It might be implicit. Maybe if ever you have a non-asynchronous function which invokes an asynchronous function, then it might automatically synthesize the harness for it, which automatically does as much as it can, gets the inserts the callback, does the next thing, inserts, and so on up to the end.
Mm-hmm. I kind of hoped for an asynchronous integer, perhaps a sequence of integers, like a nullable integer.
But right. Actually, kind of what you're saying here is that why is the return type async of int? What if you could do exactly the same thing by saying that something like this was the return type?
Yes, because I think that was what you were really saying.
Yeah, that... What we're talking about really does feel like an what we're talking about really does feel like a stream of events that come back and they do some work and they give us more events. So yeah, async and iObservable feel very similar. It can't quite like this be written exactly like this because the compiler still needs to do a state machine transformation inside this body of code. And today you can write code which returns an iObservable event without doing the state transformation. I don't know. Maybe if ever there's the keyword await inside the body, then it would do the state transformation. But I don't know. Then we start getting into magic based upon what's inside the body, which isn't a good place to be. Okay, so the comment was that yield already does that magic. If you return an enumerable and you have a yield inside you, then it does do magic. It's kind of a shame, you know, and in retrospect... in retrospect, maybe it wasn't the best way to do it. Let's suppose we have an enumerable. Really, you want to have file name... I believe is null or empty is new in .NET 4. I mean, you really, every single function wants to be like this, where it does validation on its inputs. However, this validation only happens the very first time you call move next. That's really unfortunate. And so, in retrospect, probably a better way of doing this would have been return I don't really know what the syntax would be if Iterator, like a Lambda, could have been, I mean, a Lambda is an anonymous method that you've inlined into a function. Maybe an iterator should have been an anonymous iterator that you could have put as an expression inside the function. If we had this, then the most common pattern of iterators would have been nicer to program. Yeah.
What's the reason for adding the XML liberals for only to VB?
Question, what's the reason for adding XML literals only to VB and not for C sharp? Answer, I think the answer is Anders' dead body. But it's been sturdily reanimated over the years. The original principle, and it's a really good principle, is XML just a flash in the pan. In a few years, we'll be away from XML onto some new thing. And we don't want to tie C-sharp the language to this one particular way of doing data. Okay, well, that's not true. XML will probably outlive any language that we're using today apart from COBOL. And and maybe it is time to do it. And maybe if we had XML in C-sharp like in VB, then it would be easier to write ASP-type pages that could use these features. So the objections to XML literals in C-sharp are going down, and the advantages of them are going up. And it was 4 months ago, for the first time ever, I heard Anders say, well, if we had XML literals, then this problem wouldn't arise. That's not a promise by any means, and it still remains very unlikely. Yeah. Any more questions? Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of surprises me. I mean, XPath and all those things were really new. Querying on a tree must be an ancient idea.
There was no mathematical theory behind XPath. I mean, the mathematical theory was developed, and there have been a bunch of different mathematical theories to accommodate it, different forms of logic to express it. At Microsoft Research in Cambridge, Luca Cardelli and Andrew Gordon developed ambient logic or spatial logic, an entirely new form of logic, especially for describing this kind of thing. And there have been other logics for it, but there was no beautiful, clean mathematical theory behind it, no. And more specifically, I come to ask them, what are the standard operators that you would expect on trees for construction and querying? And there's no standard set of operators that all the academic papers on the subject go back to. Every single paper has a different set of operators, basically. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Oh, sorry, one left. Yes. Yeah. And likewise, it holds back the VB stuff. But yeah, coevolution. And we're not going to introduce a major new language feature in one without the other. No, and that's the wonder of it. I mean, we're in the same corridor. We've got the same teams. We share the same design process. So most of the work is already shared, and that makes it so much easier to put into the other language. Okay, there are some specific things unsafe in C-sharp. We have really no plans or wish to put it into VB. Ref returns. This goes hand in hand with unsafe. The idea is a C-sharp function should be able to return a reference to something. Like in C++, you can return a ampersand int to return a reference to that int. It goes hand in hand with unsafe. No plans to add it in VB because it's simply not part of it. So if it does go in, yeah, it should be happy to happen in C-sharp, but not VB. So we aren't holding back the things that are hard to do in the other language. And as for the things that are easy to do in the other language, or possible, they're not holding anything back. Would be a very hard thing to introduce into C-sharp at this stage, yes. Okay, thank you very much.